Today's Teisho will be on case 48 in the Book of Serenity. Case 48 is entitled Vimala Kirti's Non-Duality. Introduction. Even if one's subtle function is universal, there's a place where one can't even begin to act. Even if one's eloquence is unhindered, there's a time when one can't even open one's mouth. Long Ya was a headless man boxing. Jiashan made a tongueless man able to speak. Who is it who can extricate himself midway? Vimalakirti asked Manjushri, what is a bodhisattva's method of entering non-duality? Manjushri said, according to my mind, in all things, no speech, no explanation, no direction, and no representation, leaving behind all answers and questions. This is the method of entering non-duality. Then Manjushri asked Vimalakirti, we have each spoken. Now you should say, good man, what is a bodhisattva's method of entry into non-duality? Vimalakirti was silent. Verse. Manjushri inquires after the illness of the old Vaishalyan. The gate of non-duality opens. Behold the adept. Crude without, pure within. Who appreciates it? Forgetting before and losing after, don't sigh. Struggling to present the gem, the man with his feet cut off in the garden of Chu, repaying with a jewel, shining bright, the cut snake of Sui. Stop checking. There are absolutely no flaws. The mundane is totally gone, but there's still a little. Thank you so much for coming to practice Zen this morning. We came here, we got up early on a Saturday morning, on a beautiful Saturday morning, and we all came here to purify body, mind, and heart. This practice of Zazen is so wonderful, so purifying. It's a great pleasure to do it with you, to practice with you. Thank you so much. This is a dialogue between two famous bodhisattvas. The first bodhisattva is named Vimalakirti. Vima is my closest I can get in Mandarin. But very famous lay teacher of a Buddhism who lived in the town of Vaishali in India, he's the subject of a sutra, the Vima Sutra, the Vimalakirti Sutra. And Vimalakirti was not a monk or a nun. He was an ordinary, actually like a businessman. But he was deeply awake, and he was able to maintain fully awakened mind in the midst of all his busy daily affairs. His accomplishment is so remarkable that many bodhisattvas come to visit him and ask him his instruction in the sutra. He represents sort of the highest attainment of enlightenment brought into everyday life. The highest attainment of enlightenment brought into everyday life. You know, ordinarily what happens to us is that we come to a sit. And if we've been practicing for a while, we meditate and we feel better. Sometimes, after a couple of periods of meditation, our minds begin to become clear, and dark or clear and bright. And we feel like a great weight is taken off our shoulders. You know, when you come to sit in the evening or when you come on a Saturday, you know, at the end of a long day or at the end of a long week, you know, you can feel very tied up, very tight. You know, every little thing that is bothering us, sort of like, it's like a tightening and tightening and tightening. And by the end of the week, we can feel sort of really bound up in our clinging, bound up in our clinging, right? And we come to sit, we do the first period of meditation, and maybe still it's a kind of a struggle to calm down, to quiet the mind, and then you know, the second sit, begin to really sink into that deep concentration, deep samadhi. And then, you know, when the sitting period is over, we get up and we feel better. You know, we drive back to our, we walk back to our cars and we drive home, go to sleep, get up the next day, and it's back to work. And a little bit of the edge is off, right? A little bit of the edge is off. And this is so important. You know, there's no, in my opinion, there's nothing like seated meditation, a deep samadhi in ushin, in shunyata. You know, this is deeply purifying, deeply clarifying, and healing. And you know, there's nothing like it. You know, you can, if you're stressed, you can go have a drink at a bar, but that really does nothing to untie those knots inside yourself. It's just sedating yourself. Or you can watch TV. And TV distracts you, but it doesn't help either. It's really quite clear that it doesn't help. So when you come here and you untie your knots, you know, at the end of two periods or three periods, you feel, you can feel deeply clarified, deeply purified. And then, you know, we go home, we go to sleep, we get up the next day, and, you know, and then, you know, we may have stresses again that happen to us, and you know, by Wednesday, it might be, you know, very important to get back on the cushion because we're all bound up again. That feeling of tightness or knottedness, you know, is there again. There's sort of like pressure on us, pressure, right? Sense of pressure. So you sit down on the cushion, you decompress, you enter samadhi, you enter mushin, and you go through the process again, right? And then onward, you know, next day. But imagine if, you know, if you practice long enough, this will really happen to you. You know, you will be in that deep state of a samadhi as you're walking around or as you're in your working in your job, you know, in the middle of all these stressors, you'll be very calm. It takes a lot of practice to get to that place and a lot of courage to work through your obstacles. But it will happen. I've known many people who are like that. And Wima, Vimalakirti, was like that. He was a deeply accomplished lay person who went through his daily life in samadhi. You know, at first, people can only achieve samadhi intermittently. You know, when you start practicing meditation, you know, you might have many sits where you're just struggling to get back to your breath and turn away from your thoughts. And, you know, after a couple weeks or after a month, you may be able to focus more fully on the breath, and the thoughts don't totally disappear, but they're on the periphery, on the margin of your consciousness. And that's a great achievement. You know, eventually your mind is able to be very still, very calm and focused. You're watching the breath go out, you're watching the breath go out. And then eventually your mind becomes clear and empty, you know. And that can take months to achieve that. You know, if you hang in there and you keep practicing quite regularly, you know, there will come a time when you come in and you sit down on the cushion and you enter samadhi very, very deeply. And it can feel actually very blissful, very beautiful. And then you might think, okay, everything's changed, you know, my life is going to be totally different. You come to the next sit and it's hard to get back to that place. You know, and then you just have to keep practicing. Little by little, you'll get to that place more and more regularly. At first, it's very hit and miss, you know. You can get into deep samadhi, next sit, not so deep, next sit, not at all. But eventually, you get there. You learn how to sort of be attuned. It's like tuning. In the old days, we used to have radios. Well, that had little knobs on them, and there was a needle, and it would go up and down this panel, and the panel listed all the radio stations from all the radio stations from the lowest numbers up to the highest numbers, and there was usually a little needle, and when you turn the knob, you know, the needle would go left or would go right. And you'd keep turning that knob and you'd hit this channel and this channel and this channel, and one channel would be classical music and one channel would be some guy selling washing machines and one channel would be jazz and one channel would be, you know, Eric Clapton and rock music. And you'd try to find the channel you liked or the channel you wanted. And sometimes on radios the needle would get broken off. It was usually a piece of cheap plastic and it was relatively easy to get damaged. So I remember having a radio myself where the needle was gone, and I just had to guess where, you know, where it was, and I would just turn the knob and listen until I heard, you know, whatever station I was trying to find, you know. So early on in your meditation practice, it's a lot like that. It's like you're turning the knob, but you're not sure whether you should go left or whether you should go right. You hit it, and then you go past it, and you go back, and you can't find it. This is a little bit like early stages of meditation. And you just have to be patient and keep turning the knob. You know, when you sit down on a cushion, there's much you can't control. And a lot of meditation practice is learning not to try to control it, just trust the process. And you sit down, you straighten your back, you watch your breath. And then, you know, if you are not trying too hard, but you are trying, you know, you'll suddenly hit the right channel. You'll suddenly feel you're in the groove, you're in that samadhi. And how long you stay and how deeply you go is really not in your control. But if you keep practicing, little by little, you'll get there more regularly and you'll get there more deeply. And eventually, you'll be able to be there all the time. I'll never forget, I'd been practicing with Genki Roshi for a couple years. And, you know, I definitely had a hit or miss with my sits, you know. Every once in a while I'd have this sit that was absolutely blissful. I would just think, this is the greatest thing in the world. And I would come back and the next time, you know, it just seemed like, you know, a half an hour just seemed like an interminable stretch. Like, how he must have fallen asleep, you know. How come this is taking so long, you know? And then next time it would just be like that, over in a second. And I asked Genki Roshi, I said, how long does it take you to get into samadhi? And he said, are you kidding? As soon as I sit down. But and I can attest to that, you know, that's definitely the case. It takes less than a minute to enter deep samadhi if you keep practicing. So you know, eventually, you can achieve deep samadhi on the cushion. And you'll notice if you come to Sesshin, as I hope you will on a regular basis, you'll notice that, you know, on the fifth day of Sesshin, your mind is so clear and bright. You know, you walk outside and everything seems alive. And then, you know, you go home from Sesshin and that lasts for a while. But you know, you get into your old mental habits and so on, generally speaking, it becomes less prominent as the weeks roll by until the next sesshin. But eventually, that sesshin mind stops going away, you know, so that you're having it all the time, or most of the time. And, you know, I had a friend of mine who, in Seattle, at the Seattle Zen Center, who was absolutely astonished. You know, after some sit, after our sitting period, he got on the bus to go home, and he realized on the bus that he was in deep samadhi. You know, and he was actually like looking around like, I can't believe this is happening. He was a very deep state of samadhi on the bus, looking at people come on the bus and get off the bus. And he told me, and he definitely told Genki Roshi. But eventually this happens to you. You can be in this deeply thoughtless state just walking around, or deeply, deeply thoughtless, deeply grounded in wuxin, just walking around. And eventually, you know, your seshin mind becomes sort of like your default mind. Well, vima, vimalakirti, is like that. Vimalakirti is in that state all the time. You know, so everybody else is freaking out and panicking and so on and upset, and he's just going through the city, calmly dealing with everybody, kindly present for one and all. So he's one person in here, and the other person is Manjushri, Wenshu. And Manjushri is the bodhisattva of wisdom. So you have these two deeply enlightened bodhisattvas having a conversation. And they both know the answer to the question. They're both talking about how they experience non-duality and how they teach non-duality. And non-duality is a fancy philosophical word, a philosopher's word, but it's a very, for something that's very, very important. You know, ordinarily, we feel separate to some degree from everything and everyone around us. And it can be to some degree, but it's always there a little bit for most people. And for some people, it's profoundly there. So, I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but when I was a little kid, when I was very embarrassed, I would contract into myself so much that everything around me seemed to disappear. I don't know if you ever had that experience, but, you know, I remember one time I had just gotten a new lunchbox. There was a television show called Zorro, and Zorro was set in Mexico, and it was about a masked Avenger. He rode a black horse, and he had a black cape, and he had a black mask and a black hat, and he had a black mustache, and he was very dashing, and he was helping the rebels fight a cruel colonial governor, the poor people. He was helping them in their uprising. And he was very dashing, and he would dash in on his horse, and his name was El Zorro. And I was in love with El Zorro, and I had to get an El Zorro lunchbox. And it had Zorro riding his horse on the cover, and he used to take his sword and he'd make a Z for Zorro on different things, including the shirts of his enemies, you know. So I had a Zorro lunchbox, and I was in, I think, elementary school or first grade, and I loved this box, and I thought, you know, that if I had this box, people would admire me, I guess on some level, because Zorro was so magical and wonderful, and they would say, hey, you know, you have a Zorro lunchbox. You must be a very cool guy. So anyway, I brought my lunchbox, and it was our time to get our lunches, and we all went to behind the coat, into the coat room to get our lunchbox. And I was walking back to the table with my lunchbox, and suddenly I looked, and everybody was looking at me, and they were all laughing at me. And I turned around, and my thermos had been leaking, and there was a trail of milk all the way to the table. And so, in my own mind, instead of being cool, I was being laughed at. And at that moment, you know, everybody, I sort of like shrunk into myself, and everything just disappeared. You might have had that experience if you've had a very embarrassing experience, or, you know, like if you have a car accident, you know, if you're not badly hurt, but you make a mistake, you know, for a moment, everything just disappears. You sort of contract into yourself. Well, I think we do this quite often to some degree. You know, so it's very difficult, for example, to go to a job interview Because you have to be present under conditions that are very frightening or unnerving. You know, so you might really want the job, but you might be nervous about whether you can get it. And you have to come out of your shell and be present. If you're too much in your shell, you know, you're not connecting with the interviewer. That's a very difficult situation, because when we're afraid or when we're we feel threatened or somewhat insecure, our impulse is to withdraw into ourselves, you know. I had this experience when I was a kid. You know, my father was in the service, in the military, and we were constantly moving in the middle of every year, and I'd always come into a new school in the middle of the school year, and so I didn't have any friends. You know, I was a stranger in my class. I'd be a stranger on the playground. And I felt very distant from everybody, you know. To some degree, I think everybody has a little of that all the time. Sometimes when you're with your best friends or people you can be intimate with, you come out of your shell and you connect. But generally speaking, to some degree, we're in the shell as we move around. And that affects not only our relationships with other people, but our relationships with things. We feel a little bit remote, a little bit distant from things all the time. You know, you could say that on your good days, you're 80% present and 20% absent. You know, 80% present, 20% absent. 80% here, 20% in your shell, not here. Yeah. And on your bad days, you know, you might be 60%. You know, if you're at a meeting, if you have a job and you have to go to this meeting and nothing is ever accomplished at the meetings, and they go on and on and on. By around the second, the third or fourth half hour of the meeting, you may be mostly in Hawaii in your head, and your body is sitting at the table. You know. So that's a very like dissociated state, but it's not so uncommon for us to be a little dissociated all the time. Actually this becomes a kind of a mental illness that we all have. You know, we all feel very separate to some degree all the time. And, you know, even with people we love and care about, we're not always 100% available or present. We make a habit out of being somewhat absent. You know, lots of people, you know, you can be in the middle of Times Square and feel like a total stranger. And it's, you know, it's not really a product of, it's not really because you don't know anybody. It's because you feel so disconnected. You know, disconnected. So basically, this problem of disconnection is quite profound, and it produces lots of problems. You know, when people feel isolated or disconnected, they're usually very unhappy. You know, they also can do terrible things because they don't really feel like they have any connection to the people around them. You know, you'll notice this. You know, if you're in a grocery store and somebody cuts in front of you and you give them a look like, why did you cut in front of me? You, generally speaking, they will say, oh, I'm so sorry, I didn't see you there. And I think it's genuine. I don't think it's artificial. You know, what they mean is, I see you. You're present to me now. I was in my shell and I didn't see you a minute ago. But please, you know, it's your place in line. I didn't mean to cut in. When people are in their automobiles, they very rarely behave that way. You know, they're much more aggressive, and it's because they don't make contact with the people inside these little boxes on wheels, you know. So people can behave sort of atrociously when they're behind the wheel, very aggressive. When they could establish some connection, they wouldn't behave that way. So, you know, people like Donald Trump are very, very disconnected. I think he is very, very disconnected all the time. And his desire to get people to notice him is really an attempt to get out of his isolation, but it's a strategy that never works. So he's constantly tweeting. People say he has to be the center of attention at all times. And that's because he feels so intensely isolated. So non-duality, that is duality, where you feel isolated. You're over here, and he's over here. That's duality. But every once in a while, we naturally experience non-duality. And that's another word for connectedness. So, you know, maybe one day you leave the zendo at the end of a sit, and you walk outside, and you notice that there's a full moon up in the sky. And you look at the full moon, and for a minute, you know, it's not you looking at the moon. It's just your consciousness is 100% moon. You know, it's just moon. If you go to Sesshin, you know, the same thing happens around day three or day four of Sesshin. You walk outside, like in the summer, and they're the same flowers as you found when you got there on the first day, but somehow now, you know, every detail of the flower seems so alive. It's almost, if you're in really deep samadhi, it's like the flower is your own body. It's like the flower is your own body. When you hear birds singing, it's like your own voice. See, that's non-duality. And non-duality, according to Buddhism, is our natural state. It's the truth. So non-duality is the truth, according to Buddhism. And duality is the upside-down view, as the sutras say. The sutras say it's an upside-down view. We feel our separateness most of the time, and that's a product of our distorted consciousness. And separateness really is samsara. And, you know, basically, connection is really like nirvana. It's really that deep sense of connectedness is enlightenment, you know. Wima asked Wenshu, or Vimalakirti asked Manjushri, what is a bodhisattva's method of entering into non-duality? And so the question is, you know, okay, I've got it. Duality is not is a problem, is the illness, and non-duality is the cure. But what? How do I do that? How do I accomplish that? And this is a really important issue because, you know, in our ordinary consciousness, we only get like half of reality. As you're growing up, you know, you encounter people and you encounter things all the time, and yet by the time you're say 12 or 13. This sense of disconnection can already have taken deep root in your minds, in your consciousness. You know, and when we're feeling disconnected, what we try to do is fill our attention with some new thing. You know, one of the things that I always find interesting is I understand there's a dimension to shopping which is really exciting, you know. So, you know, when you go shopping and you find things you've never discovered before, that is kind of an adventure. And I have gotten into that. I understand that. So I'm not being totally critical of the shopping experience, you know. I do most of the grocery shopping in my house. And, you know, when I go grocery shopping, I actually enjoy it. If I find a strange new fruit, I'm excited. You know, it's like, oh, what is this? This is called a star fruit? You know, how do you serve it, you know? I like to find new foods, you know. I go to restaurants and I enjoy experimenting with food. So, So I'm not saying that all shopping is bad or something like that. But it's definitely, you know, it's definitely the case that sometimes we try to fill the emptiness in our lives with things, you know. It's often the case people do go shopping and they come home and they go, why did I buy this? You know, why did I buy this? You know, and then, you know, it goes down into the basement or it goes, basically you give it as a gift to somebody on some occasion, you know. You wonder, why do I do that? Why do I? And some people actually are like shopaholics. You know, they actually can't stop shopping. They have like closets full of clothes and things like that that they never wear, or lots of knickknacks that they just can't stop buying. And that kind of compulsive behavior is very typical, and it's really encouraged by our culture. When people feel disconnected, they try to find a new thing to connect them. And yet, you know, this is actually like a doomed strategy, because you get the new thing and often, though not always, you know, it becomes ordinary. You know, in no time at all, you feel disconnected from it again, you know. So some things are not like this. You know, I have a Chinese bowl that my wife bought me years ago, and it's in my study, and it's pine, a design of pines inside the bowl, and every time I see that bowl, I find it very deeply beautiful and moving, and it's arresting. I look at it every time. So there are sometimes objects, you know, that we have that are so powerful on an unconscious level that we connect with them. But a lot of the stuff we buy, you know, we buy it to fill that empty feeling, that disconnected feeling, and then, you know, it just sits around and it's disappeared. It's just, it doesn't connect us to the world in the way we hoped. You know, I often, and again, if you like cars, I'm not criticizing you, you know. My father-in-law loved cars, and he would buy a used car and fix them up, and he was like car crazy, you know. And I think cars did make him feel connected to the world, especially because he would get in there and rebuild them, basically. He was an engineer who liked that kind of thing. But, you know, a lot of the time, people buy a car and they pay a huge amount of money for it, and then, you know, it's just a car. It disappears. It becomes, you're disconnected, you know, within a couple months after you buy it, right? It's just a car, you know. So buying things or getting things doesn't necessarily solve this problem of feeling disconnected, even though it's the way we usually do things. And I think nowadays we have something that's like that, which is, you know, and again, I'm an old fogey, so please forgive me, but, you know, I think texting and being on the phone all the time are also forms of trying to connect, but those approaches don't work very well either, you know. I just started some new classes this semester, and all my students come into class, and I come into the classroom, and they're all on their phones. And I say, please put your phones away, and they look nervously up, and then they put their phones on the desk, and I say, no, put them away, you know, and they laugh nervously. But they're definitely addicting. You know, when people are feeling disconnected, they reach for their phone, and it's like, get me out of my isolation is my idea. But that doesn't work either. You know, I was just reading a psychologist whose name is Flynn. He's a very famous psychologist, and he noticed that after World War II, people's IQs were going up all over the developed world. So they were giving IQ tests to children, and their IQs were going way up, you know, like shooting up. And Flynn said, how is this possible? You know, they're getting a better diet, but it can't just be diet, and it can't be genetics, because, you know, in one generation, the IQ doesn't go up 40 points, the average IQ. So Mr. Flynn said, it's really education. You know, the more you have little children reading books, developing a vocabulary, doing math, and even though we think of IQ as hardwired, it's not. Flynn says, you know, your brain, it can be programmed to make it more intelligent. And he said, basically all over the developed world, when you get public education and all this stuff, the IQs go up. And he this is called the Flynn effect. It's very famous, you know. But he said, all over the developed world, especially in the United States and Europe, IQs are going down. And this is true in Scandinavia, England, Germany, France. And they're going down fairly fast. And so Flynn was asking, why are they going down? And he said he's convinced that the reason they're going down, again, it's not genetic. He says they're going down because people are playing video games instead of reading books, and they're on their phones all the time doing things that are very routine and predictable. And they're not developing new, more sophisticated mental skills. Now, you know, they asked Mr. Flynn, well, what do you think would turn this around? And he said, people should read more books. I think there's some truth to that. But I think it's more complicated, because I think these phones are highly distracting. We don't cultivate these habits of attention that we need, you know. When you feel disconnected, if you try to solve the problem by reaching for something, even a book, it might not really solve the problem. You know, there's a different way to approach the problem of disconnection, and it's the very opposite one of the one you might suppose. So, you know, when we sit down on the cushion and we begin to do meditation, you know, something very interesting happens. You know, so if you come in, you learn how to meditate, you learn how to sit on the cushion, you straighten your back, you learn to breathe with the Dantian, the Manipura chakra. You're following the breath. You know, eventually, you're able to focus on the breath instead of being dragged away by your thoughts, right? And that can take a month or two, where you sit down one day, and instead of fighting with your thoughts, you suddenly have the breath right in front of you. And you follow the breath out, and you follow the breath out, and you follow the breath out, and the thoughts are sort of over here on the margin of your consciousness. Now, this is a beautiful moment, and, you know, lots of people in America now do what is called mindfulness meditation. And this is an example of what is called mindfulness meditation, where you're watching the breath, and when you're in that state, you know, you become 100% breath. And that's a beautiful, beautiful situation. But, you know, if you keep watching the breath, a strange thing happens. You'll notice that at some point it becomes impossible to watch the breath, because the breath actually disappears. You'll know, if you haven't noticed this, you'll notice it eventually. You're watching the breath, and then suddenly, you know, you'll find, where's the breath? And you'll notice the mind at the end of the breath, where the breath comes to its end, before the next breath starts, there's like this little blank place. But if you watch the breath, at some point, you're going to go to that blank place. Your mind is going to become blank. And this is not unimportant or insignificant. That blankness is the Dharma door to enlightenment. You know, we call that mushin or shunyata. It's, in my opinion, totally real, totally there all the time. You know, ordinary humans see only half of reality. We see what's there, but we don't see the emptiness. We don't see the emptiness that's also there. Yeah. So if you meditate long enough, you'll begin to notice that this emptiness is at the end of your breath. But actually, you'll begin to notice it if you focus on anything intensely for a while. Your mind will, you'll suddenly be aware that your mind becomes completely empty. Now, you know, if you are meditating for a long, long time, if you meditate for like 7 days, and you've been doing sesshins for, say, you know, a number of years, you know, sooner or later you'll begin to realize that, and I mentioned this at sesshin, you know, consciousness is not continuous as we think. So, you know, we think it works like this. I come into the room, I turn on the light, I see the carpet, I sit down on the couch, I grab my tea, I turn on the TV, etc. It's this, thing. But actually, that is the seeing reality that way is the product of a very crude consciousness, very crude. If you begin to meditate and you do it more regularly, sooner or later you'll notice that things are not really like that at all. You know, you'll be at sesshin sometime and you'll realize that we have moments where something becomes present to us. And then there's emptiness. And then there's something. And then there's emptiness. And then there's something. And this is absolutely regular. Everything is like this. So it's really not the case that it's something. In reality, it's like something, nothing. The universe is, you know, actually there are physicists who say this is real, that the universe itself is vibrating between something and nothing. And if you meditate long enough, you will see this, it will be as plain as day, that there's something, nothing. This oscillation between something and nothing is very, very important. You know, we Buddhists believe that's the way reality really is. The problem is people are too distracted by their phones to notice. See? It takes a lot of stillness, sitting, and mental focus to begin to undo all of our distractedness. But, you know, as I say, if you just hang in there, one day you'll be sitting at sesshin, you'll come in to see me in Dokusan, and you'll say, that's the damnedest thing, you know. You were right, you know. And this, which is what I said to my teacher. And he just laughed. He said, of course, you know. It's like in the old days when movie theaters would film in the projector would slow down. The projector was not turning at the proper speed. You know, normally on a movie screen, image is projected so quickly that you don't notice the gaps. It's not a continuous image. It's a series of panels flashed on a screen by the projector. You know, as long as it's going fast enough, your brain can't notice that there are gaps between each image. But when the projector slows down, projector's not turning at the right RPMs, suddenly you see a flash, then nothing, then flash, then nothing. Or image, nothing, image, nothing, image, nothing. Well, some physicists say that's reality, and Buddhists agree. And if you meditate long enough, you begin to notice. So these two things go together. They are reality. Something and nothing are like both here all the time. Our senses are too crude to notice the nothing part. You need to have refined awareness to detect it, right? But the oddest thing is that when you go into emptiness, and you come out of emptiness on the other side and you encounter something, you feel totally connected to it. You know. So basically, doing zazen and entering mushin is very purifying. And you might say, why do I feel so good? It's because it's removing your sense of separation and making you feel deeply connected to the world around you. And it does this by having you pass through emptiness back into the world of form, as we say. So basically, these two things, you know, nothing and something, are always are like way. Something is like a wave on the ocean of nothing. That's really true. Something is a wave on the ocean of nothing. You know, and all we see are the tops of the waves. We don't see the ocean underneath. But when you dive into the ocean of nothingness and you come out and you see the wave, you feel, you realize, oh, I'm a wave. I'm the wave. A little abstract, but when you do meditation, especially like at Sesshin, and you've meditated for 8 hours a day, and you walk outside, everything seems to be your own body. It's like the flower is you, you know. You hear birds singing, and it feels like it's coming out of your own, you know, mouth. You become one with the object of your attention. And why can't we do that all the time? Well, eventually we can, but we have to learn how to bathe ourselves in emptiness, see? And so meditation practice is like restoring ourselves to sanity. When you come here on a Saturday and you sit down, and you met some, many people came today from the start at 7 o'clock. And, you know, by the fifth period of meditation, your legs might be tired, but your brain is now so purified, right? So clear and clean, because you've bathed yourself in emptiness. And, you know, when you walk outside, everything is going to seem a little bit more alive, right? A little bit more alive. And if you keep doing this, that sense of aliveness is not going to dissipate. It's going to be there all the time. We Buddhists say that is reality. You know, reality isn't this dead, inert experience, the world we experience, because we've made a habit of dissociation. When we bathe ourselves in emptiness, we connect with everything around us, or we discover our connectedness. So, the problem is not enough meditation. The solution, more meditation. Case. Vimalakirti asked Manjushri, what is a bodhisattva's method of entering non-duality? Manjushri said, according to my mind, in all things, no speech, no emptying, no explanation, no direction, no representation, leaving behind all questions and answers, this is the method of entering non-duality. In other words, go into deep mushin. Then Manjushri asked Vimalakirti, we have each spoken, now you should say, my good man, what is your view of how a bodhisattva should enter into non-duality? Manjushri entered mushin, right? So he doesn't say anything. He's just in deep mushin. So Manjushri spoke, but Vimalakirti was silent. And his silence was demonstrating what Vimalakirti is doing, or demonstrating what Manjushri was just talking about. So it's one thing to talk about non-duality. It's another thing to be there by going into emptiness yourself. Manjushri inquires after the illness of the old Vaishalyan. That's Wenshu. That's Vimalakirti. Vima. Manjushri inquires after the illness of Vimalakirti. Vimalakirti has apparently some kind of sickness, but he's not really sick. He uses his sickness to help other people wake up, is the teaching. The gate of non-duality opens. Behold the adept, crude without, pure within. In other words, When our consciousness is crude, we don't see the emptiness. Okay. Who appreciates it? Forgetting before and losing after, don't sigh, struggling to present the gem, the man with his feet cut off in the garden of Chu, repaying with a jewel, a shining bright, the cut snake of Sui, stop checking. There are absolutely no flaws, the mundane totally gone, that's still but a little.